We'll call the meeting to order. Once we get a quorum, we'll take approval of the minutes. But the first bill up today is Representative Kahn's House File 828 and House Resolution 2, urging the President and Congress to end trade, financial, and travel restrictions to Cuba. Representative Kahn, welcome to the Commerce and Labor Committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. It's a pleasure to be here. I assume that this is an issue that you've heard no negative, had no negative input on. But at any rate, there are two resolutions before you, and they're essentially the same. And actually, my wish is, Mr. Chairman, that you would pass them both to the various places they're going, although I'm sure we'll only deal with one. One is a sense of the House resolution, and the other one is a memorializing resolution that would require being passed by the Senate and signed by the governor. I had an indication that there, except for that the Senate is having some thoughts about not doing resolutions, so I don't know if they'll do that or not. Let me start by saying that I know that's a little bit controversial about whether we should do resolutions or not, but I've always been in favor of them. And what a resolution does is it essentially gives a body the chance to speak with the voice of the body. So it is. It may not be much better than a letter to a congressman or a letter to the governor or so forth, but it is. It is a magnification of that voice. Mr. Chairman, I have many better. What this essentially does is this is paralleling something which is going on a stronger level in Congress right now. There is a bill before Congress that removes the travel restrictions and trade restrictions and financing restrictions on trade to Cuba. I do believe that both when I last saw Representative Ramstead and Representative McCollum have already signed on, and there were projections that Oberstar, Peterson, and Ellison were all going to sign on too. It's something that has passed the House and the Senate at various times, and only to run into a kind of veto by conference committee. One of these things, you have the identical piece in both bills, and then it doesn't emerge out of the conference committee. But language in the resolution is fairly simple. The wording of it, it's the same resolution that I put in last year. The wording had to be made very careful that it was positive and talked about trade and travel, and that because it had to pass the muster of support of my first co-author, who is Representative Sigel. And anyway, I would like to, instead of talking about, I do know a little bit about this. I've actually been to Cuba four times on totally legal licensed trips, of which that ability has been cut way back down. But I would like to have a couple of people who have more recently been to Cuba to talk about their experiences. And, Mr. Chairman, the first people I'd like to bring up is family who's done a lot of business in Cuba, and I'd like to bring up Ralph Kayla and his family.
Thank you, Representative Kahn. Perhaps while we are while we've got them coming, we've got a motion by are we at enough numbers yet, Mr. Wright? Representative Lilly moves the minutes of the February 15th meeting, the 8th meeting of the Commerce and Labor Committee. Are there any questions or concerns with respect to that? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
That motion carries, and Representative Kahn, I will move House File 828 as well as, well, we'll do them separately. I'll move House File 828, that be recommended to pass and sent. I believe it would go to the General Register, and then we'll take up the House resolution after that. Folks, welcome to the Commerce and Labor Committee. Glad you could join us this afternoon. If you'll just identify who you are and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Seth Kaler, and I am a sophomore at the St. Charles High School. And this is my mom, Mina Kaler, my brother, Cliff, and my dad, Ralph. And Jerry Hauser. We got involved through Cuba with when the U.S. Agriculture Cuban Expo was down in Cuba in 2003. And we were the people that took all the animals down there for the expo. We took two pigs, two sheep, two dairy heifers, and two bison calves down there for Mr. Castro. We got invited when my dad went on the China trade mission with the Governor Jesse Ventura when he was out there. And Mr. Ventura asked if anyone would like to go to Cuba. And of course, my dad, had to ask and see if we could go. But when we were down there, we developed many friendships with many people. One of them that I will remember for a long time is one with Fidel Castro. We got to know him when we gave him the tour of all the animals, and not him, like me, was raised on a farm. So he asked us a lot of knowledgeable questions and liked the way that we answered them. So then we got to become his guest of honors at many meals and plays. But if the embargo is lifted, Minnesota and Cuba will both prosper from it. We have a lot of goods that they would like, which soybeans, corn, and milk. And they will also get tourism, which will, in fact, help all the people down there.
Thank you, Mr. Kaler.
I'm Cliff Kaler, and I'd like to thank you guys for letting us speak here. If a basketball coach had a losing record for 40 years and never changed the strategy, he would be out of a job. That is the same philosophy with our embargo on Cuba. The stated goal has been regime change, yet Fidel Castro stayed in power longer than almost any world leader. Before the embargo, there were more than a dozen dictatorships in Latin America and South America. Currently, Cuba is the only country we placed the embargo on, and he's the only dictator that stayed through. Prior to the embargo, Cuba was our number one trading partner. How would lifting the embargo help Cuba? Experts say that if we open the embargo, up to 1 million Americans would travel to Cuba each year. Cuba is a tourist-based economy, so if each American only spends $200 down there, which is an extremely low number, there would be $200 million of revenue into their economy. Every single Cuban American we met in Florida was in favor of lifting the embargo, and they left for economic reasons. Cuba would get the largest economy to trade with, and they're just 90 miles off their shore. The agriculture is stunted right now because they've not had an influx of genetics for several years. Currently, their dairy are about two-thirds the size of our dairy. With an influx of our genetics, it would be an extreme help to them. The people are the ones that suffer with the embargo, not Fidel Castro. How would it benefit the U.S.? Cuba currently has bought butter from as far away as Denmark and powdered milk from as far away as New Zealand. Those are both products that we could be trading with Cuba. They have the potential to be in the top 15 trading partners with us. Currently, they are in the top 25, and that is one-way trade. They are strong in fruit, they have oil, and they have a strong medical program, all of which we could benefit from. If the embargo is lifted, they said they would buy over 100,000 cattle. There's a potential for $1 billion worth of trade with Cuba. The biggest reason is we'll have a friend with them and not a foe. I'm going to be a freshman in college next year, and when I go down there, I want to go down there to trade. I don't want to bring a gun down there. It's easy to see who benefits if you vote for this bill, but I really have to question if you vote against this, who are you representing? Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Kaler.
I'm Mina Kaler. And I want to thank you for giving us the opportunity to share our experiences and our viewpoints on Cuba. When we did first go in 2002, we went, and I was very apprehensive, quite frankly, because I didn't know what to expect down there. What I had been told about Cuba when I was growing up and Fidel Castro, I was a little bit nervous, but I was also excited. When we got there, we ended up going about a week early because we had the animals and we had to acclimate them to the environment and get them ready for the show. So we spent that week with other U.S. citizens from ADM and U.S. Rice Federation who actually educated us on the Cuban issues. And we found out they are not what we are told. Granted, we don't know everything about it, but those few times that we've been down there, And what we've learned is not what we're told is not actually what's going on. There's a lot of agendas, I think, that are there that are not for what the stated reasons are. I don't think it's... okay, I'm losing my train of thought. Always I do this. I'm sorry. But what I wanted to say, too, is that when we went there, I'm a teacher and a mother, and we visited the schools. And again, what we were told is that it's a very oppressive society, and yes, we do have a lot more freedom than they do, but going into the schools, those people are educating their people on a shoestring. The president fed and educated his people, because when there was the overthrow, they had nothing. And those Cuban exiles that are in Florida that are keeping this embargo in place want to get back what they had. When we were down there on a subsequent trip, we went to, it was another trade show. We met with a man from Bolivia. And 2 weeks prior to that, they had had a coup in Bolivia. And he was telling us about what was going on down in Bolivia and how they view the Cubans. And what he said was that when he came, it was his first trip to Cuba. He traveled through Cuba and found out that they're actually, you know, he didn't see the children dying of starvation or disease on the streets. What he had been told actually was fact, that, you know, they had looked up, that most of the Latin American countries look up to Cuba as a model for education and their education and medical. I think that even though we went on that first trip, and like I said, we didn't really know, I didn't know what to expect down in Cuba, and we went there very apolitical. I think now, though, we're trying to get people to realize that what actually is happening down there is not what we're being told. And I would encourage you guys to take the trip. You guys have the opportunities to go down there and find out for yourself what is fact and what is it that you're being told. Because it's not actually... I guess I get very frustrated because I look at my two boys and I'd much rather that they are trading partners, the friends that we've made down there, the children that we've met down there. I'd rather that we're friends with a country that's our third nearest neighbor than enemies. And so I think this resolution, and I hope it gets passed out of here, and I think it's a start in how we can make better relationships with Cuba. Sorry if I'm not as articulate as my children.
Thank you.
Well, as the final member of our family, and we'll see if Jerry has some time, I do appreciate being here. As we look at this with the Cuba resolution for going with trade with it, it can be a ho-hum, ha-ha type resolution. But I think as we go and move into this, I handed out some sheets for you. You'll see it has a real chance for you to make a positive impact on both our nation's policy and a motion that's in favor and good news for all of Minnesota residents. The Minnesota Department of Ag put out a sheet, and I gave you a copy of this that was handed out. It was put together by Craig Damscombe. This is for 2001 through 2004. To give you an idea of what Cuban purchased from us, they were number 3 in soybean oil, a big portion of Minnesota's products, number 8 in dairy products, number 13 in edible beans, number 16 in soybean meal, number 19 in grains. But if you step back, Cuba is our 25th biggest trading partner with 100% one-way trade. They have the potential to move into being our top 15 trading partners. They bought over 80,000 tons of distillers grains from the ethanol industry. Craig Damscombe and I made that introduction to their country in 2003. Prior to that, they buy $100 million a year in powdered milk. Minnesota went down and brought back the first letter of intent. The last 3 years, Cuba has been the fourth largest importer of powdered milk from the United States at $24 million per year. So I look at it, I'll come back as I move into the rest of my speech. I think there's a major line to analyze here. It's obvious that a vote in favor of this resolution benefits Minnesota producers. I have a problem trying to understand, if you vote against it, who are you representing in here? Thank you.
Thank you.
I have gotten a high sign from the chairman. I would like at least one person to say one sentence, and that's Victor Valens from.
Thank you, Representative Kahn. Thank you to the Kaler family. Appreciate hearing about your experience in Cuba, and you obviously make some very compelling arguments. I'm sure you do, Representative.
Substitute Representative, I have lots of conversations with Representative Figgum before I was elected. Isn't he signed on right away?
We don't want this
conversation with him about getting on the bill and stuff like that. And I had to adopt the primary person who I was working with. And I think there's kind of on the board of about three of us, I think. And so I said, he's just terrific. You don't deserve him as your constituent. He should be my constituent. And so then Steve said to me, oh, I actually like his wife, Maina, a lot better. So, of course, I immediately go and tell that to Ralph, and he said, that's just what
Fido said. Mr. Valens. Welcome to the
conference. Good afternoon, and thank you for having us and listening to us. My name is Victor Valens. I'm in the restaurant business. I was born in Cuba, 1950. I came to the United States when I was 11 years old. What I want to get to, and I kind of just want to ask one question if I can, please. Who in this room here has to ask permission to see their family? I have to ask permission to see my family in Cuba. I go to Cuba, I have about 15 relatives there, and my trip is different like from a lot of other trips. I usually put my things in my SUV at midnight. I drive into a foreign country real early in the morning. The question that they ask me is, or the statement that they tell me is, they still don't let you go, do they? And I say no, and that's why I'm here, and I thank you for letting us come to another country and fly out of that country to visit my family. When I come back, I have to lie. I do not lie to customs, so I do always say, if I'm asked, if I went to Cuba, that's what Cuban Americans have to go through in order to see their families, okay? We have to come into this country, and we have to lie to get back into the country and say, no, we were visiting friends in Cancun, or we were visiting friends in Winnipeg or Toronto. Because those are the ways that a lot of Cuban Americans go to Cuba. I cannot see how I see our current administration, I think I saw them about 3 years ago, our president sit down with all of his family, okay, and then all of a sudden say, this is what family values are, okay? And along with his family, cousins, uncles, aunts, grandparents, everyone, he decided that I cannot see my family except once every 3 years. So I think that after 48 years, I celebrated my birthday for the first time in Cuba last May, May 1st, in 48 years. My family always wanted me to come down there, my family in Cuba. Come on down, try to come down. But they understand the problems that I go through, but it's just incredible that, again, in the greatest country in the world, ladies and gentlemen, I'm scared to leave, and I'm scared to come back in. And all I want to do is see my family, see my cousins, my uncles. I got an 82-year-old uncle. I got aunts. I got nephews. And now the current administration is telling me that uncles and aunts and cousins do not count. Cultures are very different in all parts of the world. Our culture of family is very, very, very strong. You can go to Minnesota, you can go to Cuba and wear a Minnesota t-shirt, and everybody knows Minnesota. I want you to know that. They do know Minnesota. And it's because of what Minnesotans have done in that country. So I think that not only for the state of Minnesota, but the United States all around. Listen, I'm trying to jump because I know we don't have much time, and we have to stop. But last May, I got stopped at the international airport for coming in for not having a permit to go to Cuba. I was with a very well-known individual that asked permission to go to Cuba twice to see his his brother that was dying from cancer, who finally died, okay, and that gentleman was Tony Oliva. He was denied twice to see his brother, and he finally asked me, there is an underground railroad, okay, ask me how we can get to Cuba. He has to see his brother. Ladies and gentlemen, I do not want to ask permission to see my my family in Cuba. I hope that you folks will never have to ask permission either. I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Valens. Representative Kahn, do you have anybody else that needs to testify this afternoon? Okay, is there...
A point is that other states, I mean, the governor of Nebraska has done three trips to Cuba in the last year or so. Many other states are doing that. Very bipartisan issue in Congress. I think Representative Lutch, just like the Arizona, is the chief author of the bill, so I hope that we'll cut them along. And
let me ask, is there anyone that desires to be heard in opposition to this bill, or anyone else that feels compelled to be heard in favor of this bill, or any questions or comments from members of the committee?
I'm going to add one last line. We have taken over 30 people down to Cuba on our license. We've taken soybean growers, beet growers. If someone from the House would like to see that goal, we would be happy to host a trade delegation down to Cuba in there.
Thank you. That, for the record, that's Mr. Kaler weighing in once more.
Mr. Chairman, do I hear a field committee trip?
We could not go to the Mall of America, Representative Zellers. And you want to go to Cuba?
Mr. Chairman, a great idea. There's an open offer, I'm just saying.
Is there any other? Yes, sir. You could just come to the dais and identify yourself for the record and provide your testimony.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Dwayne Kroenke, a resident of St. Louis Park. I am a retired lawyer and now an adjunct professor at the University of Minnesota Law School. I also chair the Global Partnership Committee at Minneapolis's Westminster Presbyterian Church. One of our partnerships is with the Presbyterian Church in Matanzas, Cuba, east of Havana on the north coast. I have been blessed to be on two trips to Cuba with our church, but I do not speak as a representative of the church. Instead, as a citizen of this country, as a citizen of the world, and as a Christian, I support House Resolution Number 2. In my opinion, the long hostility of the United States towards Cuba, as evidenced by our embargo and trade and travel restrictions, is not in our national interest and is long overdue for abandonment. Instead, we should be pursuing a policy of reconciliation with Cuba. That would include restoration of normal diplomatic relations and good faith negotiations of a long list of problems. That list includes the embargo, U.S. lease of Guantanamo Bay as a naval coaling station, Cuba's expropriation of property owned by U.S. persons, Cuba's jailing of dissidents, and many others. House Resolution Number 2 is an important step in that direction. I applaud that such a move is seen as in the economic interests of many Minnesotans, especially those in agriculture. I urge this committee to approve and pass on House Resolution Number 2. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kroenke. Is there anyone else that desires to be heard? Representative Dominguez, you had a question or comment?
No, just a comment. What Victor Valens didn't mention was if you want a little taste of Cuba, he has a coffee shop over in Minneapolis on 38th and Grand. Check him out.
Well, thank you, Representative Dominguez. This is the
very good
committee, and I guess advertising is allowed. Any other comments or questions? Seeing none, Chair Renews. Yes, sir. Welcome to the Commerce and Labor Committee. You should just identify yourself for the record and provide your testimony with as much brevity as you can. We're about 10 minutes past the amount of time that we had allocated for this item.
Okay, I'll try to be brief. My name is Joe Callahan, and Victor spoke very strongly about the effect of the travel ban on Cuban Americans in particular. But I wanted to talk a little bit about other aspects of that. The way that they try to enforce this measure is they send out letters from the Treasury Department to people saying that they think they went to Cuba and they owe a $7,500 fine. So if they think that they went to Cuba, So then they'll call people up and try to arm twist them to settle this without going through any kind of a court hearing, offer them to be able to pay a fine of $1,000 instead of the $7,500. In order to keep this all quiet, to keep it out of the press so that it's not well known to the American people what's going on, that they're trying to deny people to go to Cuba. And many Minnesotans have received letters like this from the Treasury Department. I've received two of them, so they're just pending there waiting to see what's going to happen with that. So I encourage you to vote and to encourage our federal representatives to put an end to this policy.
Thank you, Mr. Callahan. Is there anyone else desires to be heard, or any other comments or questions from members of the committee? Yes, ma'am.
My name is Joan. I'm a strong supporter of Cuba. And
excuse me, Joan, do you have a last name?
Malrich.
Thank you.
Opposite of female form, Malrich. I might change it, though. There is no question that we should take down the immoral travel ban and the blockade, which is really a blockade, not an embargo. But we need to do it for the right reasons, which is simply there's an immoral act of war against a sovereign country. When our reasons for doing something are based on money and profits instead of humanity, the results are not grounded in truth and reality of moral principle, which is what we all need to search for each day. Taking down the blockade for the primary reason of pacifying the farmers and business people who want to make money is very selfish. There's very little words expressing the idea of buying from Cuba. So far, this is a very one-sided bargain. Saying that we should bring down the blockade and the travel ban for the purpose of bringing democracy to Cuba is also very backwards. If people were allowed to travel freely to Cuba, we could see that they have been lied to by our politicians. We would find out what real participatory democracy is all about. And that is why we are not allowed to travel to this humanitarian third world country. Quite simply, the politicians or the moneyed interests who own them do not want us to see the truth and reality. Yes, do what is right. Take down the travel ban. Take down the blockade. Take them down because they are immoral acts that reflect very adversely on this country. And the fact is, Cuba still wants to trade with the United States. It's always wanted trade. It's always wanted dialogue. It's always asked for it. But Cuba is no longer financially dependent upon the U.S. for trade. It has it's made partners with other countries also.
Thank you, Ms. Mallard. Mm-hmm. Appreciate your testimony.
I will point out, Mr. Chairman, I promise the former speaker that I do not involve administration backing or anything. I'm going to hide plainly about
it. And Representative Kahn, you haven't bashed the administration at all. That said, anyone else who desires to be heard, or any other comments or questions from members of the committee? Seeing none, Chair renews his motion that the House File 828 be passed and referred to the floor. Is there further discussion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Motion carries. Any opposed? House Resolution 2. Chair moves that again to the House Resolution 2 be reckoned and passed and sent to the floor. Further discussion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, motion carries. Thank you, Representative Kahn. Have a good afternoon. Thank you to everybody that came to testify. House File 765 is Representative Loeffler's file. Representative Loeffler's file is Motor Vehicle Insurance Database Development Required. Representative Loeffler, welcome to the Commerce and Labor Committee.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Chair will move House File 765 be recommended to pass, and it looks like there are no other stops. Recommended to pass and sent to the floor to the General Register. Recommended, Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. It's nice to be back in the Commerce Committee, which I had the pleasure of serving last term.
Welcome home.
Thank you. We as a state have had a long-term policy, as have most states, that saying part of the responsibility of owning and driving a vehicle is to carry insurance on that. But we know that just putting a requirement in the statute books isn't sufficient to assure complete compliance. And the challenge in this area in particular is assuring compliance through monitoring and opportunities to interact with uninsured motorists. Unfortunately, that oftentimes is at the scene of an accident in which the person whose vehicle or whose body is injured is dismayed to discover that the person who has just run into them and does not cover the required insurance. When motorists drive without insurance, they obviously shift costs to the rest of us. Our uninsured motorist premiums, component of our car insurance, goes up. Uncompensated care costs for any medical personnel that might be involved gets passed on to other payers. And if it's one of those really tragic incidences in my new committee, the Health and Human Services Committee, we hear a lot about people who are traumatically brain injured and disabled for life and how they use up all of their private resources and then go on to public assistance. And so, you know, we want to work hard to make sure that people do comply with the law and do carry insurance. Many states have used technology to solve this problem. They've created database and electronic exchange directly with the insurance companies so that they get real-time status information on whether or not a vehicle is insured, and when insurance is dropped, they can intervene with that particular vehicle owner and make sure that they lose their privilege to drive until they reestablish it. It also increases dramatically the compliance rate. States that have implemented this have seen reductions that have been just amazing. Currently, Minnesota has about 15%, it's estimated, uninsured drivers. The state of Georgia has actually reported on their website that they've gotten down to 3%, and they started at about a similar level that we have. And so this is a way to help us comply. I have some witnesses who will also talk about the impact of this on our criminal justice system, which we know is always terribly overburdened with a lot of paperwork and a lot of heavy responsibilities. And this is one way to lift some of the redundant work that they're doing that really doesn't help make our community safer. I mentioned that this has been implemented in a variety of other states. I learned earlier this week from Mr. Bob Johnson, who's with the Insurance Federation of Minnesota, that NAIC, the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, I believe is the acronym, has been working on a national model that they're about ready to release so that we would not have to do our own development. Instead, we would be compatible and take advantage of development and maintenance costs by others. And he would be prepared to address any questions you might have about that. With that, Mr. Chairman, I will conclude and let our witnesses come forward. They are from the Criminal Justice Coordinating Commission of Hennepin County in Minneapolis and the local governments of Hennepin County. And I must say that in itself is a model of how local governments can work together to problem solve that I think is good to highlight, and this is a good bill to bring that forward. So with that, you may call forth the witnesses.
May I ask Representative Loeffler, are you aware of any opposition to your bill? Has anybody come and visited with you is there anybody here to testify against this bill? Okay. We're running a little bit behind. If you can have your witnesses proceed as rapidly as possible, I'd appreciate it.
I would be glad to do that.
Thank you.
And first I'd like to call on Commissioner Linda Koblick from the Hennepin County Board.
Commissioner, welcome to the Commerce and Labor Committee.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. I am here, of course, on behalf of the Hennepin County Board, as well as the Criminal Justice Coordinating Committee. Paul Ostro is the current chair. I chaired it in 2006 where we developed this proposal. I thank you for your time and attention today. It's nice to come on something where we can partner with the City of Minneapolis, and both of us at the same table can agree on the item before us. We appreciate it. I am bringing this forward for your consideration today. This proposal was developed from Chief Joy Riccolo when she was with the Minnetonka Police Department as their chief law enforcement official there. It was vetted through the Criminal Justice Coordinating Committee in 2006, part of our legislative agenda there. The Hennepin County Board has approved that agenda, so it is included in that as well. As I said, Chief Joy Riccolo brought this forward. She noted the great number of citations that were issued in by law enforcement agencies in Hennepin County for no insurance, which were ultimately dismissed when it was later proved that the person had insurance. There's some statistics and numbers that will be provided to you later on, but it results in great inefficiencies, not only to the courts system, to citations personnel, to law enforcement agencies, and to the persons receiving the citations when they have the insurance and just don't have the card in their car. So we feel it was an inefficient and costly way that we could get at now with technology tools in a much more efficient way. And there are multiple states doing this now and models out there. So we're not looking to reinvent the wheel. We're looking to say there are efficiencies here. We support this. We've come together on a common agenda. We believe systems will save money, time, and resources across all boards. So we ask for your support of this.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Yes, sir. Good afternoon. I'm Paul Ostrom, a council member with the City of Minneapolis, and as Commissioner Kolblik mentioned, I am the current chair of the Criminal Justice Coordinating Committee, which is, we think, perhaps unique in the state. It brings together the sheriff's office, the city and county commissioners, city and county attorneys, police, probation, public defender, to really look at how we systematically make the law enforcement system more efficient and more effective. I also bring, as a part of my background, 12 years as a municipal prosecutor for the cities of Blaine and Middle Canada. And I would just suggest that if you think about the impact in terms of efficiency of 19,000 dismissed tickets a year, those are each tickets that a law enforcement officer has to write out, that have to be filed with the court, people make court appearances for, clogging our calendars, that in and of itself is a pretty compelling reason to support Representative Loeffler Hill. But in addition to that, the issue of no insurance is one that has a very real impact on people's lives. It drives up the rates of insurance for those that pay. It is a really very human cost in terms of the impact on people when people are not insured. And as was mentioned by Commissioner Kolblik, the experience in other states is that there has been a significant drop and the number of people that are not insured when this legislation has been passed. Specifically in the state of Georgia, after the implementation of their electronic insurance compliance system, the percentage of uninsured motorists went from 15% to 30% to 2.5%. That's a huge difference, and it's something I think would be a major, major improvement. How does this work? Essentially, electronic data is submitted to the Department of Public Safety's vehicle registration database. The clerks would check for insurance at the time of the re-registration of the motor vehicle. Consumers would still have to carry that insurance card that I'm sure each of every one of you have today with you. You still have to have that with you. And police officers, though, would have access to that insurance information that would reduce significantly the number of the unwarranted no insurance charges. So it would increase compliance in terms of insurance coverage, but it would also be something that would be better for those people that actually have insurance. So it is something that I think would make a huge, huge difference in terms of resources for the state in the criminal justice system. And again, as the chair of the Criminal Justice Coordinating Committee, we believe this would make a major difference in terms of the efficiency of the Hennepin County system and all the other county systems as well. So I want to applaud Representative Loeffler for her leadership and hope the bill has your support today.
Thank you, Councilman. And it's just so nice. I mean, we've got the City Council, the County Board, and the state all represented at the same table. I'm sure hoping we get a good photograph of this so preserved for posterity. Representative Loeffler, do you have any other witnesses that desire to testify today?
I think we'll just stand for questions and you can hear from some other concerns.
And I think what we'll do is take all of the testimony and then we'll see if there are questions from members of the committee. Thank you both very much. Is there anyone else that desires to be heard with respect to this bill? Johnson, welcome back.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, Bob Johnson, Insurance Federation of Minnesota. I had a chance yesterday to meet with the chief author, and I'll give the nutshell testimony here today, and it's primarily that our industry has been working with the legislature and for a number of years trying to figure out a better way, to enforce our compulsory auto insurance laws, and we've had some successes and some failures. The most recent one was a failure. And I think the comment here today, we support effort and know that we need to move this to an electronic basis. What we don't want to do is have Minnesota do a unique electronic data basis, and that really is where the national debate is right now. There is being developed, Mr. Chairman and committee members, by the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, the 50 state regulators that our Commerce Commissioner is part of that. They have an uninsured motorist issues working group that's developing national uniform standards for monitoring compulsory auto insurance and financial responsibility laws. And that's really where we need to position ourselves. So from my perspective in the industry, Florida, Texas, Wyoming, Oklahoma, New Mexico, the District of Columbia are states that have just recently come on board. The standards are still being finalized. I don't have the exact date of them, but the NEIC is working with the Insurance Industry Committee on Motor Vehicle Administration, the IICMVA. The key thing is this. We need to do this in a uniform national way so we don't have unique electronic data records requirements and reporting, which will be costly at expense to drivers. And so I just haven't had a chance to finalize with the chief author and whether we need a group in Minnesota, but the timing of that effort from our industry's perspective, and I think there, the Department of Public Safety will comment, there was just a report issued to the legislature by a study group on this issue. It was issued in November of 2006 that a pretty big group of individuals actually focused on insurance verification. And I think Pat McCormick will comment on that. I think the key thing is we need to stay in the right position to take advantage of the uniformity and not have a unique state law or system development. So, Mr. Chairman, I don't know whether that's my testimony. I think whether that actual database language, I haven't had a chance to square that with what's coming. We definitely want to be in position with what's coming. And I think there's a lot of people that have looked at this recently that would agree that that's the better direction to go. So I wanted to go on record with that, Mr. Chairman. We'll work with you and the legislature and the chief author here towards that, towards those ends.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. And while we're waiting, I believe Ms. McCormick, who wants to testify as well, Chair is going to revise his motion. This is going to public safety and civil justice. No? I thought there was a remedy requirement. Did you want to see this, Chair Mullery? Okay, the next one. Then, as my kids say, never mind. Ms. McCormick, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Pat McCormick, and I'm the Director of Driver and Vehicle Services in the Department of Public Safety. And while we oppose this specific bill, we certainly also applaud Representative Loeffler's intention and goals of this legislation, because our aim also is to decrease the number of uninsured motorists in Minnesota. The report that we're passing out is a report that we were required to provide to the committees on transportation at the beginning of this legislative session. And the report's recommendation is at this particular time there would not be a substantial impact by implementing an electronic verification system in Minnesota. Minnesota's current rate of uninsured motorists is about 10%, a little over 10%. And there have been studies a few years ago that did have it at 14.6%, but the rate currently is about 10%. And we are doing that just with enforcing the current laws that are in place. Certainly an electronic system at some point in time would be feasible, but I think we also realize, and I'm a member of the American Association of Motor Vehicle Administrators that are working on this insurance verification system and getting the standards in place, but those standards are not ready at this time, and a few states are working on this pilot in order to try to ensure that whatever system is set up would be feasible among all the states, because I think all of us agree that with the mobility of drivers today, we need a system that would be able to be utilized across the states. In addition to that, at this point in time, Driver and Vehicle Services information system, we have many priority projects that we're working on right now in terms of technology, and so this is a substantial technology change that would need to take place. There would have to be certainly a lot to address the privacy of the data that we're dealing with, and so this is a substantial project, and the costs associated with it are substantial as well. And so for those reasons, I would respectfully oppose passing this bill at this time. And I would hope that the committee would be able to review the report that was done, and certainly we're always available to continue working on ways that we can address decreasing the number of uninsured motorists. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. McCormick. Is there anyone else that desires to testify with respect to this bill? And by the way, I want to commend Ms. McCormick. I contacted her in her office over the summer with a constituent concern, and I think I had an answer within about 15 minutes. They're just, they do a splendid job. Representative Loeffler, when you and I spoke yesterday briefly about this, you were aware that there's a national effort to try to do a national database. My assumption, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, is that your goal will be to try to incorporate whatever you do with this bill. If there's a larger effort being made, that your goal is to be part of that effort, I assume, right?
Mr. Chairman, that is absolutely correct. The bill is drafted. It says that they have to look at working at using the databases developed for other states. I had conferred with Mr. Pender, and he could put clarifying language together, but he felt that the language of the study right now tilts it towards that preference, and that it wouldn't be necessary at this point to necessarily do that. I must also say Ms. McCormick left me a message this afternoon. We hadn't had a chance to talk ahead of time, but I did have a chance to review the report that she referenced and has provided to you. And you'll note that in there it does note, as I had testified to, that other states have used these kind of models successfully. The bill as before you does not say we are going to implement it, that we are going to fund all the technology changes. Instead, it says we're going to do a study and get the right people around the table to look at all aspects of what would we want out of this national model, so that if our representatives participate in those discussions, they've identified them, and that it's coordinated with our local governments. The report in front of you does not address local government impacts, and it's my goal to make sure that whatever system we buy into is compatible with the computers in our cop cars, so when they go to rush to the scene of an accident, they can plug in and get this information. And I don't want our local police departments buying new computer systems that aren't going to be compatible. As these sort of standards are evolving, I think we should have a group that are actually looking at that and working on it. I don't see it as a conflict for us to start the study group at this point in time and work with the Department of Public Safety and others as this national model and the national standards evolve.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler. Are there questions or concerns from members of the committee with regard to this bill? Seeing none, Chair renews his motion that the file pass and be recommended to recommended to pass and refer to the floor. Is there further discussion? Seeing none, clerk, or all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, it passes. Thank you. Next item is House File 611. Representative Anzalk moves that House File 611 be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register. Representative Anzalk, your maiden voyage.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members.
Representative Mullery.
Well, Mr. Chair, aren't you continuing the tradition of the Commerce Committee that freshmen's first bill, they have to bring treats to everyone?
Yeah, that's why his bill won't pass. But go on, Representative Angel.
Mr. Chair and Representative Mullery, treats are after depending upon how we do.
Well, that would be a new custom for this committee. But Representative Anzalk,
thank you.
Please proceed.
Thank you very much. Members, House File 611 is a very modest bill having to do with workers, ability to communicate without fear or intimidation. It's about workers being able to communicate in both private sector employment and public sector employment. Joining me in helping pass this bill today are Teresa Joppa, staff attorney from Council 65 of AFSCME. Also, Brad Leto is here from the AFL-CIO, and Jen Alschwager from Education Minnesota. My experience with this experience of workers feeling unable to communicate freely in the workplace occurred during my 12 years as a representative of the Laborers International Union of North America, a union representing largely construction workers. And from time to time, workers would complain that lunchroom conversation, work conversations were monitored by companies, by supervisory employees. And from that, we go to the electronic age in the public sector, where we get complaints of public employees being unable to freely communicate in their workplaces, either electronically or in their workrooms, lunchrooms, coffee rooms, hallways, and so on and so forth. This bill specifically would allow employers working with their workers to develop reasonable rules concerning all of these different kinds of communication. I think that that is a very important safeguard to prevent any abuses that might occur. Quite frankly, Mr. Chair and members, the area of dispute here, of course, most often involves email communication. And I can tell you that I have reports from throughout the state of employees who have been reprimanded by supervisors simply for communicating with their collective bargaining representative about matters regarding when is the next meeting, when is the next grievance hearing, when is the party, the retirement party for Mary, who's retiring after 30 years. So this involves some very, very mundane and usual and customary kinds of communication between workers. This legislation also has a remedy section, which in the case of an arrangement or a workplace where there is a collective bargaining agreement in place, it would be the collective bargaining grievance procedure that would govern any dispute involving this issue. And in a merit shop situation, the damages are limited to wages and benefits lost by the individual not to exceed $1,000. And the cost of producing the communication, whichever is greater. So with that, I stand ready to answer any questions, and I have capable assistance from the staff attorney from AFSCME, Teresa Joppa. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Anzell. Just mechanical issues first. There's a division report in the absence of Chair Dabney, who I believe this went to. I'll move that division report. Is there any discussion or comment with regard to receipt of the division report? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. That motion prevails. The division report is received. And Representative Anzalk, there's a request by Public Safety and Civil Justice to hear this bill next, particularly with respect to the remedy provision, and therefore with regard to the testimony, I would leave, for the most part, the remedy discussion for the purview of the Public Safety Civil Justice Committee. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Would you like me to
If you would
bill?
Identify yourself, please, and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Teresa Joppa, the last name spelled J-O-P-P-A. I work for AFSCME Council 65 as their staff attorney. I've been with AFSCME for 6 years. Before that, I worked for a law enforcement labor union for 11 years. This bill was written in order to get both employee bargaining units and unions on the same page as the employers about what kinds of rules should we have concerning communications in the workplace that have to do with the union, whether it's a notice about a union meeting, whether it's a notice that we got to get people together to meet about a grievance that has come up, whether it's, to, as the representative indicated, we're having a retirement gathering, what have you. We are finding that a lot of different employers are writing different rules or all of a sudden coming up with new rules when they don't like the substance of a communication that's gone through the workplace. And sometimes it's something that's just put in a mailbox, a little flyer or something. Other times it is an email that's gone by. Many employers that I deal with have been most gracious and not had issues with the types of communications that I'm talking about. But more and more and more we are finding employers that are coming up with rules on the fly or saying, well, we're having problems all around, so we're going to ban these types of communications altogether. We're all familiar with the old union bulletin board in the workplace, but today many people work in many types of different locations, yet still work for the same employer. And we're finding that that old bulletin board, you know, with the cork board and the little pins, just doesn't work in order to get people news about, you know, a union meeting that's coming up next week or whatever it happens to be. And so we wrote this legislation so that both the employer and the employees in the union could all be on the same page about how should these communications be treated.
Thank you, Ms. Joppa. Representative Anselk, is there anyone else that you have? I know you've got some folks here to answer questions as well, but are there others that you have testifying in favor of the bill?
Mr.
today?
Chair, I do have backup, and I'll use them if necessary. Okay?
We got phone a friend and all of that stuff available. Okay. Is there anyone else that desires to be heard with respect to this bill or in opposition to this bill? Yes, sir. We'll let you two race down and see who gets there first. How's that sound? Come on down, though. You're in the on deck. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself.
Mr. Chairman, Paul Larson. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Employee Relations, and in that capacity, I also serve as a state labor negotiator. I've been a state employee for over 30 years. In listening to the discussion of this bill, I think there are some merits with regard to communications to employees by their union regarding a meeting notice or to the extent of some type of personal communication regarding a grievance meeting or something like that. But as I see that the bill is written, is overly broad and would create, in my opinion, a lot of what I would call a controversy in the workplace. As an employer for the state employee group of approximately 40,000 employees, most of our employees do have computers on their desk. And we often get caught in partisan campaign emails that are sent out to employees. Employees receive those emails. They do not want them. They're sent out by and maybe an innocent in nature email might be broadcast out by one of the employees that's a union representative, and then that in turn then is broadcast out sometimes to the entire agency, where we have thousands of employees that are connected with that email. It's not uncommon for those employees that did not want that email to contact us as an employer and put what we call blocks so they do not get those emails and so on. We also have complaints regarding elections for certain union offices within the employer organizations, and again, this becomes a distraction in the workplace. I do want to add, though, that there's, you know, we are reasonable. We allow communications for meeting notices and so on, but I don't see the limitation in this legislation. In my opinion, I think this is overly broad, and I think that the ability of the employer to try to keep controls on this is lost with this legislation. I also have concerns about the remedy. Currently, if we discipline an employee that's covered by a labor agreement, the labor agreement provides for a just cause provision, and under the Public Employee Labor Relations Act, any employee discipline provides for a dispute resolution procedure, including arbitration. I think this is a matter that we should keep within the confines of the labor agreement and between the employer and the union out of the court system. So I guess those are my comments. Thank you.
Thank you. And I believe there was one other gentleman that desired to testify, or two. Thanks again.
Thank
Good afternoon. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. And thank you for this opportunity to testify today. My name is Dave Dietrichs, and I work for the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. And I am here today to let you know that the Chamber opposes this bill because we believe it's preempted by federal law. Now, before I delve into the specific issues of language in this bill, I'd like to predicate my remaining comments upon two applicable rules of law that have been delineated by the United States Supreme Court in this area. And that case is from 1959. It's called San Diego Unions versus Garmin. And this is actually considered seminal law in the area of union activity as pertains to the provisions in this bill. And there are two rules of law that are applicable here, and I'd like to read those to you. And it says, first, when an activity is actually or arguably subject to either Section 7 or Section 8 of the National Labor Relations Act, states as well as the federal courts must defer to the exclusive competence of the National Labor Relations Board. Moreover, the failure of the National Labor Relations Board to define legal significance upon the act of a particular activity does not give the states the power to act. So with those two principles in mind, I'd like to address a few provisions in this bill. Mr. Chair and members, first on line 1.15 in regards to communications, including electronic documents or more specifically emails and text messages, I would just like to bring to your attention a notice that I have from the National Labor Relations Board. It's actually posted on their website right now about a hearing that's occurring on March 27th next month. And there are two issues that are being resolved before the National Labor Relations Board that day. And the first one is whether employees have the right to use their employer's email system or other computer-based communication systems to communicate with other employees about union or other concerted protected matters. Another issue that they're exploring is whether or not the employee's use of the employer's email system should be a mandatory subject of collective bargaining. Clearly, this is an area of federal law that's being resolved at the federal level, which we believe means federal law controls and state law is preempted in this area. Second, on lines 1.19 through 1.21, the subdivision dealing with prohibited practices, we believe this is governed by Section 8A3 of the National Labor Relations Act, which defines unfair labor practices by employers against employees. Specifically, under this section, it says employers may not discriminate in regard to either hiring or tenure of employment because of union activity. So going back to that Garmin case of the Supreme Court, we believe that the National Labor Relations Board has purview over this section. Similarly, in lines 1.22 through 1.24, we also believe that this is an area already covered by federal law. The National Labor Relations Act, Section 8A1, states that it shall be an unfair labor practice for an employer to interfere with employees in the exercise of their Section 7 rights, which are rights to organize, bargain collectively, or other concerted activities. So again, we believe that this would be a Section 7 right of employees that would be protected against unfair labor practices under Section 8, which would then be arguably or actively under the purview of the National Labor Relations Board as dictated by Garmin. And finally, Mr. Chair, I know you said the remedy section will be covered more in public safety, but I just want to point out that in the first line, it talks about being a choice of remedies for violations of this section, and we see an inherent problem there. If there already is a union that's been certified to represent employees of a company, that means that there is no choice about how a grievance should be followed through upon. There is no civil remedy allowed. You're supposed to follow the applicable grievance procedure outlined in the collective bargaining agreement. And so therefore, Mr. Chairman, members, the Chamber believes that the principles of federal law already govern these issues, and moreover, our employers are concerned about union business being conducted during work hours. Therefore, we believe that this is preempted by federal law. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Dietrichs. I believe there's one more gentleman that desires to testify. Good afternoon, and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Craig Johnson. I represent the League of Minnesota Cities, and I'm here today to present concerns that the League has with House File 611. I appreciate very much the work that the author and those supporting his efforts on this bill have done to work with us to address our concerns. We are not asking for specific changes to the bill in this committee at this time because I think we're working toward getting some of our concerns addressed as this bill moves forward through the process. But to tell you quickly where we feel there are needs for things to be addressed in this bill, we specifically think that there would be a tremendous amount added to the certainty of what this bill does if the definition of communications, as appears in lines 1.15 and 1.6, excuse me, Mr. Chair, had a phrase added to the end of it that simply said, pertaining to union business or labor organizing as provided under state or federal law. To make it clear that the communication we're working to protect here is actually the communication that labor unions and their members do regularly, or organizing that is legally being done by a union trying to organize in a workplace. We also have a number of concerns with the prohibited practice section in subdivision 2. We think the language is a little unclear as to exactly what is allowed to be regulated and what isn't. We think there's a tremendous potential for unintended consequences there. Literally, it says employers are not permitted to discipline or discharge an employee because the applicant or employee has received or responded to a communication from an employee or labor organization. That means the response could have something put into it that was not permitted normally in the workplace, and we as employers would not be able to take action to remedy that, even if it was something that potentially caused problems for another employee, was complained about as being harassing or offensive, or was political in nature. I don't believe we are at odds over with the supporters of this bill over what the intent is of this language. We're just trying to work out language that actually directly defines it in the same way. So the rest of the concerns I would highlight are in the remedy section. I won't go into details on those as the chair requested, except to say that we echo the concern the chamber raised about having a dual pathway for claims. I think it should be done through the collective bargaining process and the grievance procedure, with unions using that as their tool, and have definite concerns about any mandatory awards that only affect one side in this. If there's fairness to it, then maybe the same court costs and attorney's fees should carry over if the employee does not prevail and the employer is found to be correct. Just a fairness issue, and one that we don't think is really necessary. We think most of the grievance procedures actually handle these issues pretty well where a problem comes up. With that, Mr. Chair, I will conclude my comments.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Appreciate your time this afternoon. Is there anyone else that desires to be heard on this bill? Other than members of the committee, I'm sure we'll have some comments and questions, but seeing none, Representative Anzelk, any other comments?
Yes, Mr. Chairman and members, four quick points. One, reasonable written policies and rules will be developed in the old-fashioned way, the employer sitting down with workers and reaching an agreement. What a novel idea. These rules, once developed and agreed upon, will be posted. If there is there are incidences of allegations of violations, the grievance procedure will take place. Secondly, federal preemption. Most of us know that federal preemption does not apply to Minnesota public employees or Minnesota workers who are not in a collective bargaining arrangement. And quite frankly, The National Labor Relations Board has not shown much effectiveness in dealing with Minnesota labor relations problems in my experience. Thirdly, the issue involving clutter and distractions in the workplace and email communication back and forth, especially email communication of a political nature, I would inform the committee that that interaction is a two-way street. We see interaction of a political nature between employers to employees that employees find offensive and intimidating from time to time. So I'd make those three points, and ask Teresa Joppa for any additional comments that she might have.
Ms. Joppa.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the preemption issue, I just want to say a few words about that. I typically deal with solely public employees in my job for AFSCME Council 65. We represent people who work for cities and counties and school districts and public nursing homes, charitable hospitals, and the like. You regulate those things as a matter of course in a couple of different chapters in your Minnesota statutes. You regulate employee relations for all kinds of other smaller workplaces that don't fall under the NLRB or the National Labor Relations Act. And actually, the little bit of research that I did on the subject led me to believe that it's somewhat arguable about whether or not the NLRA, the National Labor Relations Act, would govern this. Actually, I think it's in comports with what the National Labor Relations Act would say about allowing employees the right to choose to join a union, the right to be active in their collective bargaining organization. So in that way, I think this is a permissive kind of statute that does not conflict with what's in the National Labor Relations Act. And so I beg to differ about how much preemption we're going to have here and what kind of problems might come if somebody were to challenge the statute later on. Firstly, I'd just like to see it get passed.
Thank you, Ms. Joppa. Is there anyone else who desires to testify with respect to the bill? Are there questions or comments from members of the committee? Representative LaForce.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Representative Van Zylk, I did have a couple questions. First of all, the bill is incredibly broad in its scope. If you look at it, lines 17 and 18 of page 1, you're covering many, many thousands of people. You're talking about employers like the University of Minnesota, MinSCU, Dewar, the counties, and a number of private employers. And I hear testimony from the League of Minnesota Cities that you've worked with them. Did you reach out, for example, to Dewar or MinSCU and get their thoughts regarding this bill when you were crafting it?
Representative
Mr. Chair and Representative, no, I didn't.
Representative
Mr. Chairman, I just had a couple questions. I'll stick to Subdivision 2 pursuant to your wishes here regarding the committee's jurisdiction. On line 20, line 1.23 talks about communications from an employee organization. Is it your intent that it be defined as employee organization under 179A or the exclusive representative?
Representative Ansel.
I'll defer to the attorney on that one.
Ms. Java.
I wrote this legislation originally, and I intended it as is defined in employee organization or labor organization at lines 1.17 and 1.18 to encompass those labor organizations defined in Chapter 179, which covers non-public employees, and then public employees as are covered under 179A03 Subdivision 6. So it covers both types of workplaces.
Representative LaForce.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. And I believe, quite frankly, that this is an inartfully drafted bill. And said, I mean, if you look at 1.23 and you look at the definitional section, for example, under 179A, what your language does, essentially, if it passes, is opens up the workplace to every union, so to speak. And I guess if I was the exclusive representative for a particular building or area, I wouldn't be real thrilled about the prospect of another union having access to my membership for decert elections or for representation elections, for example. As we all know, they can be pretty hotly contested. They can be well-funded. So I think it does a disservice to the exclusive representative, who we try to honor under PELRA. We give the exclusive representative a lot of authority and a lot of privileges, and I think that's a good thing. So I think that dishonors that. It also puts the workplace right in the middle of these fights. I mean, think about it. You got a school, for example. You may have a decert election going on, and now you've opened up the school and its email and everything to this fight. So I would encourage you to go back and look at line 1.23, for example. And along those lines, Mr. Chairman, I'll just make one final comment about applicant. This bill gives certain rights to applicants for jobs, and this isn't my bill, but I've worked with unions in the past, and I don't know many dues-paying rank-and-file union members who are thrilled by the prospect of their union expending union resources to pursue claims on behalf of someone who is not a member of the union and doesn't pay any dues. But that's just my observation. So, Representative Anzuck, I hope you would reach out to some of the stakeholders to try and craft a better bill.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Representative, just briefly, I'm a member of a labor union, and I can assure you that all 56 affiliates of the AFL-CIO are totally in support of this legislation. But I appreciate your concern about Minnesota workers.
Representative Mahoney.
I look at this bill, and the sad part is that we actually have to do some of this because the National Labor Relations Board is such a weak organization and refuses to actually take on good cases against employers. I applaud you for bringing this bill forward, and I only wish that you could make it stronger. And as far as a union member being unhappy, representing the unrepresented and the unorganized, then it's not a very good union member. Every union member, every person that pays dues at a union is happy to help the unorganized better their life and make a better life for this country. The National Labor Relations Board, if they were doing their job, we would not have to have these type of bills come before us. They have sliced and diced that so bad that even Republicans in Congress are supporting the bill out of California to strengthen it and to bring it back to what it was supposed to be. So it's about time we start doing these type bills. Maybe the federal government will get the message. Maybe the federal government will actually start doing their job if we start doing it for them. Thank you for bringing this bill forward, Representative Anzell.
Are there any other comments or questions from members? Representative Burns.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have two questions for the author or for the attorney. One is, and they're both related to Subdivision 2, and I certainly understand the goal here, and I'm wondering if some of the language is a little bit overbroad. When Representative Anzell talked about the fact that we do have the ability for the employer and the collective bargaining unit to negotiate some rules, which is the second part of Subdivision 2, it appears to me that the first part of Subdivision 2 is a very clear affirmative defense, and that, for example, if an employee were, in responding to an email, said, hey, I'm pretty upset with you, Joe, I'm going to go run you over after work today, that employer would have no recourse whatsoever at all to say, hey, you guys can't be threatening each other at work. It appears to me that that is a pretty big loophole.
Representative Ansel, you defer to Ms. Jaffa.
For the question, Mr. Chairman. Well, it's our perspective that the last part of this paragraph where reasonable rules will be set up by the employer working with the union concerning that, I think most workplaces that take a look at this will say, well, we don't want any threats. We don't want any harassing type language. We don't want that kind of communication going back and forth. That's not the intent of this. This is for the getting out the notice about the meeting, the grievance. The arbitration is on Thursday, whatever it happens to be. It's for that kind of communication. It's the Labor Day picnic. It's coming up. Who's bringing the brownies? Who's bringing the, you know, the beverages, that kind of thing. That's the intent of this. I think the representative that proposed the amendment on Friday and that is here now for you in the last part of that subdivision really took care of that part of the concerns nicely that we had discussed on Friday in the other committee. And I think that would take care of your concern.
Representative Burns?
Possibly.
Yeah, I'm not convinced. As I read that, I think that's okay. Still a pretty big loophole. And Mr. Chair, a second point, if I may, or question. How many times per day would you anticipate employees would receive these types of emails? Ms. Chappell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, I really couldn't say because I deal with hundreds of employers. Our AFSCME Council 65, which is outstate, AFSCME, cities and counties and school districts alike, I really couldn't tell you. The idea is that people will read this information on their break time or on non-working time, their lunch or after work when they punched out at 4:30 or 5 o'clock in the evening, then they'll access it. But we would maybe call a personal email from the union. They'll see, oh, I don't want to read that, delete, or, oh, I need to know that this is happening on Thursday, and then they'll save it and note it on their calendar. And so how often will people send an email? How often will people post something into somebody's mailbox at work if they're a teacher or a police officer or a social worker? I really couldn't say.
And the reason, Representative Burns.
Quantity?
And the reason I ask that question is I think some of the points made by Mr. Diedrichs, I can imagine certain times of the year, maybe around an election or around a union election, where the pace would get very intense. And I very much understand what you're trying to do, but I'm also sensitive to the fact that productivity would be affected. And I think there has to be some sort of reasonable limit. You know, maybe 1,000 emails per day is too many. Maybe 100 is too many. And maybe 50 is too many. And I just want to kind of get your feelings on how many is too many. How much is going to now become a disruption for an employer?
Representative Ansel.
Mr. Chair and Representative, that's a really good question. I think we need to step back and focus on workplaces where we all have been in various places in our lives. And workplaces that are the most productive are where workers are comfortable, happy, working together collegially, and able to communicate with one another. And to say that we can standardize how many communications or anything like that, I think just isn't in the real world. So standardization, rules, posted, can eliminate a lot of the problems that you envision, I hope.
Thank you, Representative Ansel. Does Jeff have anything to add to them? Or Representative Burns, anything else?
No. And I just no,
and then you keep talking.
I do.
Representative Burns.
Thank you.
I do that, too. Representative Burns.
My point, Representative Ansel, because I understand what you're trying to do, but my point is I think this might be a little overly broad, and if we can work on the language to provide the protections that you want to do without making it too disruptive. So that's it. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Burns. Representative Zellers.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Representative Ansel, to your last point, you know, working on the family farm, I don't think I was happy. I know I was overworked, and I was probably the most productive there than I ever was, but it doesn't mean that the work I was doing was any less important. So I disagree with you that we all have to hold hands and sing kumbaya every time we go into work every day. But that's not my question. You know, I'm real concerned, you know, in listening to Representative DeLaForest and some of the other testifiers here, that we're creating a whole new standard that no one else has seen before. And I'm curious, are some of these emails going to be able to include fundraising, either for the unions, for candidates, for political parties?
Idea. Mr. Chair and Representative Zellers, first of all, I think as far as your real life experience, you're one that could use a union.
But my stepdad's 6'4 and 280. You can be the guy to go to organize.
And secondly, to your question, in all seriousness, again, it's the rules. I can't imagine any agreement on rules between the employer and the employee to include the kinds of things that are not in the best interest of the operation and the functioning between workers and employers. And certainly the rules would not, I can't envision, would allow that kind of thing, political.
So. Representative Zeller.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anzalk, I take it that's a maybe, because we're putting into law some of the guidelines, the rules that will be meshed out later, could be, maybe not. And Mr. Chairman, Representative Anzel, I guess that's my concern with this as a whole, is that we're going to put in a whole bunch of big boxes to maybe be filled in later on, and if the fight isn't at the time as necessary, they may or may not be able to do this, and we're going to open up a whole Pandora's box here that come October, November, worker production is going to go like this, and maybe when we're fighting out what's going to be in the rules, what happens to worker production then?
Well, Mr. Chairman, if we go back to the testimony from the Chamber of Commerce, it's clear to me that the Chamber will be instructing its member employers to most certainly be tough negotiators about any of the happenings that you would like to prevent from getting into those rules. I have confidence in collective bargaining. Workplaces work best when workers and employers sit at the table as equals and reach agreements on behavior. That's been my experience, and this language does not predict anything other than that.
Thank you, Representative Anzel. Any other comments?
Yeah,
Representative Zellers?
One other question. The preemption discussion, Ms. Joppa, kind of you dismissed it. You said if you're not in a collective bargaining agreement, you're not going to qualify. You won't be covered under that. How many organizations are we legislating for, the many or for the few? I mean, is it a matter of one or two, or is it 200 or 300 that are not under a collective bargaining agreement?
Ms. Joppa?
Mr. Chairman, I got asked the other day when I was here on Friday how many public employees there are in the state of Minnesota, and I don't really know the answer to that. I don't know if anybody knows the answer to that. We'd have to go to the National Labor Relations Board and the office in downtown Minneapolis and ask how many unions they have registered and how many workplaces those unions cover, and then that would just be those particular private employers that are encompassed by that. And then we have to go to the Bureau of Mediation Services and ask them how many private employers do they see and how many unions. I don't know. And but I guess if you want to define it back down into are we legislating for the many or are we legislating for the few, I think you are legislating for the many. I tried to write this in a way so that we were legislating for the many so that everybody would all get on the same page about all of these types of communications in the multiple workplaces that people find themselves in every day.
Thank you, Ms. Joppa. And just a point I'd make, if federal preemption does in fact apply, as Mr. Diedrich said, then they don't have to worry about it. Then federal preemption applies, and they don't have to worry about complying with Minnesota law. Representative Zellers, do you want to finish up?
Yep, one more question, Mr. Chairman. As far as the communication with the board and the old-fashioned cork board that's been established, using a computer, an email, using an employer's text phone for text messages gets into a whole new realm when it comes to expenses, especially if it's a text message where you're charged per text message. What about using the employer's equipment for union communication, for union fundraising, for union whatever it may be? Now, this is a direct cost.
Representative Adams.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Zellers, again, it goes back to what the rules say. What the rules say that were negotiated between the employers and the employees. I can envision an employer saying, absolutely no. No use of the computers, no use of technology that I own, that I have provided to you as my worker. And the employee would have two options, agree or continue to negotiate.
Thank you, Representative Anzel. That concludes. Representative Little Forest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just have one more question maybe for Ms. Joppa about how this works regarding the reasonable written policies. I'm sorry if I missed it. Does that modify communications received on a work computer or communications received in all the other places, the mailbox, the break room, et cetera?
Ms. Joppa.
Mr. Chairman, it's intended to cover all the different kinds of communications that the parties, the employer, and the union will be able to set up rules to cover any and all types of communications in the workplace, be it in any of the forms that are set out in at line 1.15 or D in subdivision one.
Mr. Chairman, final comment, Mr. Representative.
I just, what if in the workplace they don't have a collective bargaining agent? I must be missing something here. I mean, you might have a workplace where nobody's organized yet, and with whom does the employer negotiate regarding these reasonable written policies?
Mr. Chairman, we covered that on Friday in the other committee and discussed the idea that if there is no other collective bargaining agent, as is described in line 1.25, then the employer would be able to make the rules on their own.
Okay.
Nobody to negotiate with, you're going to set up the rules. That's how it works in every other entity that I'm dealing with day in and day out. Sometimes I get questions from non-union members about how should this apply to me.
And thank you, Ms. Jeff. If my sense is if that question keeps coming up, you may want to delineate it in the language of the bill. And you got a chance to do that before it goes to Chair Mullery's committee. Is there any other comments or questions by members of the committee? Seeing none, Representative Anzelk renews his motion that the House File 611 be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Committee on Public Safety and Civil Justice. Is there further discussion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, say nay.
No.
Motion carries. Thank you, Representative Anzelk. That concludes our business.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members.
I do have, folks, before you run off, there's two announcements. There's several bills in the memo dated February 16th that have been referred to Labor and Commerce. February 12th memo referring bills to the Telecom Regulation Division, and you will be getting an email, but I intend to schedule the Freedom to Breathe Act for discussion and resolution on March 1st, Thursday, March 1st. So mark your calendars accordingly. We might be going a little late that day. Thank you all very much. We stand adjourned.